Yeah, talk to me about chemistry.
Well, some of the other people involved in this question regarding the secondary production of whatever molecules. During this process, you know, when the sodium chloride is acidified and stuff like that. So,
right.
Some of the things that are being raised, statements have been made about no possible production of, you know, certain elements, you know, such as chlorine, etc. But there are other factors that have to be considered in that. Not only sunlight, you know, like the gamma isomer, but also other forms of radiation. Now, these other forms of radiation that can affect this process are going to be, well, pretty much all the radiation from the heavier elements, such as, let's say, X-ray, you know, things like that.
Uh-huh.
The fact is that once the chlorine dioxide has been created and then eliminated incredibly quickly, you know, like as you know, per the Cornford work and others, you know, proving that the chlorine dioxide is very temporary and then it leaves.
Right.
But there's two possible processes there. One is the fact that the chlorine dioxide is caused to break up immediately because of the acid interaction, and the other one is the absolute fact that chlorine dioxide will break up when exposed to certain radiation.
Okay.
So we have, as an example, we have a paper in Science Direct, which is titled "Core-Level Excitation and Fragmentation of Chlorine Dioxide." Now, this paper actually talks about exactly that, the other processes which can be used to change the state of chlorine dioxide.
Uh-huh.
But this sort of change, you know, that is, in this paper, they use actually, well, I'll just quote it here. "The electron structure of the element selectively excited radical is studied by X-ray absorption and total cation yields." So basically what is taking place here is the use of radiation to actually cause the breakup. So here's what occurs. Fragmentation of core excited OClO is reported. Photoelectron-photon coincidence spectra are recorded, indicating that singly and doubly charged fragments are formed. Fission of the doubly and multiply charged OClO leads to singly charged fragments. Now, this is really important because these singly charged fragments are incredibly dangerous. You know, they're, well, I've read papers on this stuff, and it's actually quite hazardous material.
Okay.
So the question is, exactly what is occurring with the chlorine dioxide, which is being produced and then quickly eliminated? Now, the Cornford work is from 1971, and during 1971 at Vancouver, there was, well, there was definitely radiation around. There was actually, during 1971, if I remember right, there were actually nuclear-powered ships parked at Vancouver Island. There was quite a protest about that. And then, of course, right around that time, there were the three major nuclear blasts taking place at up at Amchitka Island in the Bering Sea.
Uh-huh, right.
There were also a lot of above-ground tests taking place in places such as Nevada, areas like that.
Mm-hmm.
So there was definitely a lot of transient radiation, you know, being projected in all directions.
Sure.
the question there is, during 1971, during that test, was there sufficient radiation present to alter the natural, the outcome? The outcome of those tests? Well, it could have been possible. Because definitely radiation was at a fairly high point, you know, during your radiation exposure. 1971, a person could look at the sun and every other thing to find out what was actually happening at that time. But right now, the potential for a similar issue, with this, especially using the chlorine dioxide as a model, is very possible because of the Fukushima issue.
Mm-hmm, okay.
The Fukushima reactor meltdown, multiple meltdowns, now has involved six reactors, not just one. It's not like 3 Mile Island. It's like 6 3 Mile Islands that cannot be controlled. If 3 Mile Island would have progressed, you know, without, you know, the people involved getting control of the cooling water and the, you know, the expired, let's say, the fuel rod, you know, the tanks and stuff like that where they were kept cool. If they couldn't have got control of that, they would have, 3 Mile Island would have definitely become the one in Russia. What was that called again?
Chernobyl.
Yeah, Chernobyl. It would have been a Chernobyl for sure if they hadn't got control of the cooling factors. Now, Chernobyl, there are two different rates of results of that. One involves 1 million deaths, but the other one, the honest one, involves 4 million deaths from Chernobyl. Now, the radiation that is coming out of Fukushima, by the time it's done, it will produce a minimum. You know, if you're looking at it honestly, at what will happen, you're looking at a minimum of 85 Chernobyls. Now, the radiation coming out of Fukushima right now is it's documented, and you can actually find sites, research things like air current testing out of Norway and stuff like that, which actually shows the amount of radiation that's in the atmosphere and in the air that we breathe right now, and it is massive. It's beyond control. And what is being registered now is one of the predominant radiation clouds that actually blankets all of North America is one of the really bad isotopes of cesium, which has a 600-year half-life. Now, this complete blanket of that radiation, and of course the radiation that hit is actually the ongoing wave structures, mm-hmm. They're going to be everywhere, and they will definitely affect the outcome of any testing on chlorine dioxide. And there's no way past that. So we go back to the document that states that yes, this is exactly what happens, and we get to core level excitation and fragmentation of chlorine dioxide. So this paper it's been around for a while, and it's it's cited here and there, and it also it's gone through peer review. It's from 2005. Yeah, you know, so it's been around a while, and there doesn't seem to be any negatives. So therefore, we can assume, and in this paper, I mean, all of the charts, you know, the printouts on the spectroscopy and stuff like that. So here we're looking at one graph that shows total cation yield of OClO with spectral assignments. And so all of the emission spectroscopy is definitely here in this one paper that actually shows exactly what's taking place and the fact that, yes, chlorine dioxide can be caused to break down by ambient radiation of the levels that are out there today.
Okay.
Therefore, but remember that chlorine dioxide, each particle becomes a charged particle of its own. It's not a free radical anymore. It's multiple free radicals. Okay, go ahead.
Well, I'm accepting or acknowledging you. So radiation or the existence of it and levels of it influences the ability for chlorine dioxide to be broken down, but there still is also a factor as to how the chlorine dioxide is formed. I mean, the elements that are used to form it in the first place.
We know that.
Getting back to the chlorate versus chlorite or even potassium chlorate, etc., as well as the acid, as well as the concentrations of the chlorite, for example. So,
well, you're looking at the acids, you're definitely changing the pH in the electrical field. And that's basically the way that I believe that the chlorine dioxide is broken down in that process. But remember that the chlorine dioxide exists in a couple of different states. You know, like there's the gas state and there's also the liquid state, you know, that is derived from solids. So if you have ClO2 negative, that can be written as sodium chlorite. So you still have the original base molecule.
Right.
But 100% of the chlorine dioxide that it can produce has been produced and broken up by that interaction. So the acid causes it, right, causes the production and also causes the demise.
And would it would be correct to say that the type of acid chosen would also affect the duration?
In the papers that we have touched on,
yeah,
the timelines are definitely less than a second, but some of them are incredibly fast and some of them are less than a third of a second.
Right.
There's a definite change in there, but we're still talking about, decimals of seconds.
All right. That's where I've gotten in terms of understanding, in the sense that, okay, chlorine dioxide is produced, but for a very specific and very small time.
Yeah.
And it could be said that the cascade, the choice of the material as well as, meaning the chlorite versus chlorate, the source material as well as the acid, and that combination then affects how quickly the cascade occurs, that you're going beyond ClO2, that molecule, where it's breaking down to the rest of what it does.
Yeah, but you got to specify ClO2 negative. You've got to say that species, because the other one has a different charge, right?
Exactly. That's,
but
yes.
In other words, if it has a different charge, it has different attraction potential?
Yes.
You know, we're talking about, you know, the nuclear force, and we're talking about, you know, the strange attractors and things like that.
Right.
Okay, so if those things, that's why there's such a difference between sodium chlorate and sodium chlorite.
Mm-hmm.
The acid doesn't affect one of them, obviously, because of the charged state.
I'm preparing and starting to write my next article, and I started reading about the sodium-potassium pump. I saw some videos that were describing it, and most of these descriptions, when they make references to the potassium as well as to the sodium, they put the charge on them. They put them both down as being positively charged, but they tend to just have them isolated unto themselves. They don't show them in pairs, so to speak, you know, that positive. Because as it turns out, chloride tends to be the negative that they are paired with.
Hold it, sorry, Adam. I've got to actually back you up a little bit.
Sure.
When you're talking about the potassium,
yeah,
you have to do is look at the decay it produces and what that decay is called, because the decay causes the firing. So you have to look at the three kinds of decay. You have to actually look past these, you have to look past the images that are presented and look at the actually what is occurring in the decay. So yeah, it took me a while too, you know, to get to this.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at the decay itself, and you look at, let's say beta negative, and there's alpha, there are subunits, there are different types of decay that produce different energies with different capabilities of communication.
Mm-hmm.
So if the element decay, if you want to communicate from one thing to another, you need a target. Now, the cell makes its own targets and places them, some of them come in through diet and stuff like that, but places these targets, in other words, these amino acids, near to or right on top of or right the edges of the voltage-gated ion channels.
Right.
You have the chlorine one, of course. You have calcium, sodium, potassium. These voltage-gated channels, but there's only three of them that are really well-defined. So when you look at the fact that amino acids are placed by the cell at these particular, I don't know how for sure they're attracted there, but they are. I don't know how they're placed there, but they are. And they become the targets. In other words, it would be like certain materials want to conduct electricity better. So if you had an excessive power surge come through wiring, and it leaves that wiring because of its excessive state, it will go to the most easily recognized target. You know, in other words, if you are standing by the wire and you're carrying static electricity, well, you're gonna get that charge.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to actually have an attractive state. So this is where the difference. These things you have to consider when you talk about these different elements and the decay produced electricity. You know, the charge?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you have to look at exactly what that charge is and how that charge is different from the others. So now, like I say, you got to take it to the next level now. You have to look at the decay itself. Beta negative, etc. Beta, alpha, such as that, these different decays. And that's the part that you have to look at next when you look at the cells, and then you'll see how they fire and why they fire to where they do fire. And then when you see that difference, then you're going to see that those firings actually occur pretty much at the same time, like in the case of the sodium-potassium pump. But one firing produces a high-powered charge that moves really fast. The other one produces a low-powered charge that actually is slower. The electricity, the arc itself, is slower. Now, no one is talking about that because it goes against E equals MC squared. But that is how the sodium-potassium pump works, from those two different charges that are produced from two different elements at two different speeds and at two different strengths. So, yeah, that's one of the things about the Krebs cycle. It's very complex, but in the end, there has to be more to it. There definitely has to be gold present. There definitely has to be acetone. We know that there is. There has to be deuterium. We know that there is. And there has to be actually sound or vibration. And of course, we know that there is. Your body is always making vibrations or sounds.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
You know, the scare response and stuff like that?
Yep.
You know, so you hear a really loud noise right beside you and you're climbing completely out of your skin. I mean, that reaction is exactly instantaneous. And it causes you to react to the sound. In other words, you have an outside force causing a reaction inside of your body. So, of course, that sound, or whatever, must absolutely trigger the fuser in the cell. Remember the fuser idea?
Yep, I do.
Jar in a jar?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay, so that has to trigger that, and that causes an instant transfer of a pre-programmed response. In other words, run.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Plus, it produces the energy to facilitate it.
Yeah. Well, the thing about it is, yeah, the actual fear factor, you know, the sound itself causes a singular response, and then of course once you get moving, then the rest of your body can figure out what they should be doing while they are running.
Yeah.
You know.
I also found I found a description of something called chloride shift, which was I found interesting, and that's in Wikipedia, and it described the process wherein chloride is drawn into the cell, and as a replacement for CO2, which is diffused out of it for carbon dioxide.
Well, you just look at the charge states. You know, go back to that cell wall idea.
Yeah.
You know, and just take a look at the charge states, and you can see, there's potential for many different things to be drawn into the cell if the charge is right. If they're small enough to go through the sodium-potassium pump and the charge is right,
yeah.
Well, yeah, those things can be drawn into the cell.
We have, over the past few years, focused so much on chlorine dioxide and, you know, and telling the tale of, you know, the due diligence and the fighting that it does and the destruction that it does all outside the cell, that we spent very little time or attention to appreciate what valuable things are happening after that first interaction. And now we're also discovering that the chlorine dioxide itself is really not what you're seeking. You want to get rid of it and minimize and get and not have any effects or any involvement with the chlorine dioxide, but it's what's left over, it's what happens after that occurs. And so I'm, you know.
Well, no, we have that figured out.
Yeah, I know. I'm saying we have it, but at present we're a very small community. It's growing, but.
Well, it all goes back to the immune system itself, you know, the Krebs cycle. You know, if that cycle is actually operating, you know, cell respiration, if it's operating exactly as it's designed to operate,
yeah,
you'll never get sick. There's no bugs, you know, no pathogen, no virus, no bacteria, no anything can actually defeat a human cell. It's perfection. So, basically what we're looking at with, let's say, the MMS idea, you know, the chloride matrix, you know, we shouldn't even be just saying MMS. What we have to be doing in this sort of thing is actually talking about the multiples of the chloride matrix that are out there.
Right.
You know, whether it be a singular acid or whether it be the five acids plus perborate, you know, the WF10. The chloride, the sodium chlorate mild acid produced matrix, there are, that I know of now, there are five different ones, six, or six different ones. And they all lead to better health. Whether it be a secondary feature, like the two of them, two of the chloride matrix are actually used to clean pesticides and herbicides out of water.
Mm-hmm.
You know, fungicides, pesticides, herbicides. The two of them are doing that, and that also really helps health. You know, the human health idea, eh?
Right.
It also helps your DNA and all that other kind of stuff. So, you know, then you have WF10, and you have the MMS, and then you have the serine et al. Chloride matrix, and before that you have the DCA. Now, all of these things are beneficial to human health. It's not just the MMS we're talking about anymore.
Right.
We are talking about multiples of the sodium chloride idea, you know, the chloride matrix.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so in other words, the analogs. So now there's an incredible amount of possibilities here. You know, so basically what you have to do is, if you combine or not combine perborate, and you look at the WF10 idea, so you're looking at multiples there of possible states of ingredients.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. So if you have five, so let's say five to the fifth power, you know, you have an incredible amount of combinations possible. And then you have the states of when you're mixing it also. You have, like, okay, so do you develop to a certain state or do you not? But do you add a second acid or do you add both the chlorate and the second acid, you know, to change its state?
Uh-huh.
So the possible analogs, it almost gets, it's overwhelming, the actual amounts of analogs that can be produced out of this stuff, eh?
Mm-hmm.
So, back to the idea of the chloride matrix, it is safe to assume that sodium chloride combined with five acids, that's acetic acid, ascorbic acid, citric acid, humic acid, lactic acid, all of these acids cause the ClO2 produced to immediately break up, you know, within a microsecond.
Right.
We'll say less than a second across the board, because that's the way that it looks to me. It cannot last for more than possibly a half of a second at the very most. You know, the chlorine dioxide itself. And then the chlorine dioxide is gone, and then the molecule becomes safe. But there are other things that can be done with this stuff. like I say, the multiples, the analogs of this. And then you can go back to the DCA. And the DCA can very likely be also included in this. You know, so there would be more multiples. So you could make, if the goal is to make, you know, to produce incredibly small molecules that the cell can take in,
yeah.
Well, then you want to go to the simplest forms. You know, so you'd want to go to the single acid idea. But, you know, go ahead and use all five of them. You know, at separate installments, we'll say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then you get a really broad band of effect, no doubt, because of WF10, there's no question that this stuff is effective, eh?
Right.
You know, it's, you know, you read the patents and you read the trials and this and that and the other thing. This stuff is effective. There's just no way to say that it isn't. And we're back to the five acids with perborate. Now, perborate is nature's way of dealing with mold and fungus. So if you have a cancer, as an example, if you have a cancer that is based on mold or fungus, well, perborate is definitely going to be beneficial.
What is it made of or from?
I don't really know. I have to really look that up. I looked that up back in 2002, and I looked at all the chemistry of it and everything that I could find at that time, because I was actually using it. You know, I was actually using it in, I'll say exactly what I was doing. I was working for a company in Vancouver, and we were dealing with the leaky condos in Vancouver, you know, to eliminate the mold and stuff in them. And we used perborate exclusively. It was the only material that was accepted worldwide.
Uh-huh.
And that was absolutely safe to a newborn baby even. You know, it's the only material known to man that can deal with mold effectively. And this stuff is cheap. You know, we were buying, it kind of looks like icing sugar, and it tastes like orange juice, say. So we were buying 60-pound bags of it for right around $75 a pop, eh? You know, it's just a sodium derivative is all it is. It's, you know, sodium perborate. And it's absolutely effective. You cannot say it any other way.
Mm-hmm.
Mold will never, ever live again where you spray that stuff or sprinkle it.
Mm.
You know, so the perborate is added to the WF10, and as soon as I saw their workup on it, when I saw the perborate, I actually smiled. I thought, yeah, these guys actually know what this stuff is. Eh? Mm. So.
Question, when, you know, one of the things that excites me about this, first of all, is there's some clarity, or there certainly can be some clarity with some legacy science that's been done. You know, we can tap into this. It's not that we're in a little an isolated group with no precedence. There are analogs to this, and there's scientific research, university based, and so there's a reference that we can kind of point to. It could also, I believe that it can reduce the amount of, you might say, adverse reactions that people have likely had, and we can start to see what a true, say, healing experience is. I mean, I'm talking specifically about Herxheimer effects, diarrhea, vomiting, things like that.
Yeah.
I don't know if it eliminates it at all, but it should become clearer. If it occurs, it should be clear what did not cause it. I'll put it that way.
Well, actually, you know, in the MMS idea, you actually should have diarrhea when you're taking that stuff.
Uh-huh.
If that's what you're talking about, right?
Well, it can include diarrhea. It can include vomiting. It can include Herxheimer effects. I mean, I've experienced all of them.
Yeah, well, it's you should experience those, because those are the basic ways that your body gets rid of poisons, eh?
Uh-huh.
You know, say if you drink poison, the first thing you want to do is vomit. That's your natural response, eh?
Uh-huh.
You know, and stuff like that. And also if, let's say, if your liver dumps out a bunch of stuff, yeah, you know, it goes into your bile, you know, your gallbladder, your bile, and stuff like that. And if it's really adverse and your body recognizes it as adverse, well, then you're going to get the diarrhea.
And it's going to kick it out.
Yeah, your body wants to kick it out instead of having it laying around in your intestines and then being reconstituted into whatever the hell it was and put back into your body, eh?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, your digestive system, it's not just your stomach. You know, the food product that's actually, you know, the value of the food actually comes mostly out of your intestines. Eh?
I see.
Your body reabsorbs the food value out of your intestines and then what is completely used up while you expel. So you can see why, yeah, well, if you have poison in your body, you're definitely going to throw up. You're definitely going to be coughing up the stuff, you know, because, you know, the antibodies are going to be clearing your lungs. You know, and you're trying to cough it all out, so you're going to be developing the phlegm and all that other kind of stuff to carry the stuff out, and the diarrhea. I mean, it all makes sense, eh? Even the headaches make sense, because if you're getting headaches after taking this, it's because the stuff is killing the HeLa cells that are in the base of your brain and in your brainstem area.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that when I took this stuff, I felt the headaches too for, you know, just a very mild headache for about 3 days. But I knew that I was on the right track.
Mm-hmm.
You could tell because, you just actually feel a difference. You think better too. As soon as you go through this stuff, your brain actually starts working right again, eh?
Yeah, that's probably the other thing about this is we want things to be convenient. And I say that, myself included, but if you're in this healing mode, you want that to be convenient, you want it to be on your schedule, you want your medications to taste okay. You know, they're starting to make vitamins now for adults in gummies. You know, I mean, like Flintstone vitamins in chewable gummies in nice cherry flavors and stuff. You know, it's all candy. We're big children with just adult candy now. And yet, all of that stuff has chemistry to it that can change and alter the effect. They can actually be adverse in their particular effects. But, yeah, I was thinking that, well, maybe it would cut those kinds of things down. But that's something that's an individual thing, because from one person to the next, you don't know just what is in one person's body versus the next, what they've gone through, what they've been exposed to, what their diet has been, what their intake has been. All that stuff goes into that environment.
Yes.
That manifests as a certain pathology.
Well, the vitamins are a really interesting point. A person could talk about that for a few sentences. Now, there are two different models of vitamins that are used. They're actually brands, but they're actually vitamins that are designed to remove radiation. You know, like from your body, if you have been exposed to radiation, there are vitamins you can take that really help that.
Uh-huh.
And I can't remember the brand that's made in the United States, but I am actually holding the container from the stuff that's available in Canada. And it is called InnoVite, formula H dot H dot. InnoVite, formula H dot H dot. Now the H's mean healthy heart. But these bottles of vitamins are 300 tablets in each bottle, and they're available in Canada at a company called Nature's Fair. So when I first looked at really cleaning my body out, the first thing I did was a rose hip tea cleanse, and then I hit the formula Healthy Heart Vitamins. So the way that you do this is you take your age, and you know that for every multiple of 10 years of your age,
mm-hmm.
you have to take these vitamins for 1 month. So at the time that I first took these vitamins, if I remember right, I was 54 years old then. So I took them for 5.5 months. And I took a bottle per month of 300. So I took 10 a day for 30 days for 5.5 months. And at the end of it, I can tell you, I did feel different. I felt better. I absolutely did feel better. You know, in other words, I never got tired no matter what I was doing, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Still had the breathing issues. You know, I definitely had breathing problems because of the exposure to the chlorine dioxide here in Kamloops. It's unavoidable in Brocklehurst. So anyway, that's what kept me looking, and as a matter of fact, I got the cleanse idea, you know, the rose hip cleanse and the vitamin idea directly out of the internet for uses such as I've already described, you know, like the when you're exposed to radiation and stuff like that.
Right.
So anyway, I did all of that, and then I moved directly into the research again for other methods. And of course, I come across the MMS idea, and it really rung a bell. That's when I really started looking at the MMS itself. So we're talking about coming up on 4 years ago that I looked at the MMS as it is today. But I already knew about it as the, you know, the work out of England and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
I knew about that many years ago, about the so-called free radical treatment of cancer and stuff like that. But moving back to this MMS idea, I did all the research on it, and I realized, well, yeah, there's definitely, there's something here. This is valid, you know, and because of other information. So eventually I got my hands on some of the stuff, and I did the 15 drops twice a day thing.
Uh-huh.
And didn't hurt me a bit. You know, I went through all of the stuff. You know, I got the, but remember, I'd already gone through a rose hip tea thing. I'd already gotten rid of a lot of stuff in my body. But believe it or not, when I started on the MMS, I still got the stuff, you know, coming out of my intestines and stuff like that, and the worms and this and that and the other thing. There were still things there, but not to the amount that you would expect. They are definitely were, though. But after, if I remember right, I actually wrote that down somewhere. I think it was the sixth day, if I recall right. I think it was the sixth day that a massive pus came out of my left lung.
Mm-hmm.
And it was quite a bit. You know, I can't say for sure how much, but it almost choked me to death. I was actually just about overcome by it. You know, I was actually contracting my lungs in a really severe way, actually trying to vomit it out of my lungs, because it was that much, eh?
Yeah.
And, of course, when it got up into my bronchial area and stuff like that, and then up into my throat, well, geez, then I was out of air. It actually blocked my throat off, eh?
Mm,
wow. So when it did come out, and believe me, it did smell like death, eh?
Mm-hmm.
Smelled like dead some damn things, and it was. Then I had to throw up. You know, it was that bad. Eh?
Uh huh.
But anyway, then after that, I mean, very quickly, I realized that I could breathe again. Eh? So this is the result of the MMS. But there were other factors such as the vitamins and also the rose hip tea, which I did for 2 weeks. You know, things like that.
Yeah. How did you spell that? Innovite.
Yeah. INNO-VITE.
Yeah, okay.
Formula H. They're pretty expensive. I just bought a bottle from my mom. They're like $68 for a bottle.
Oh, okay.
Of 300.
Uh-huh. Yeah, 30-day supply.
Well, if you take 10 a day.
Right.
Yeah. But, you know, if you're just an ordinary human being, you know, like you can take either one a day or two a day. But I got my old mother to take two a day.
Uh-huh.
You know, keep her right on the edge, eh? Because she's like 79, so.
Wow.
But at any rate, bottom line on it is, yeah, she's, you know, the things that I've done with her, you know, to keep her health up, yeah, it's working. You know, she doesn't get the bad flus every year and stuff like that.
I see. Wow. All right, well, I'm still obviously learning, and that's probably the other thing is, you know, we take this journey into dysfunction. I see, and so many times where someone will say, well, as you get older, this happens and that happens, and the bells start ringing and stuff now, because I realize it's not because we get older that these types of things happen, the deterioration or the degeneration of function or the onset of disease. Is more so as we continue to be exposed to certain types of substitutes for nutrition. I mean, you got food that really has no nutritional value. You've got water that has all the various, you know, chemicals in them, and we have, oh, and not even to mention the HeLa cell now, and which is basically programmed future diseases, and this stuff is happening all the time. And then we're of this mindset of vaccines for everything, so we're getting away and away and away from what's natural, and we think that, or we rationalize that just getting older these things happen just as a consequence of growing older, and that's, well, it's just not true. But because we're so experienced in the degenerative process, and we've rationalized it, not nearly as many people are that familiar with the process of healing and what that involves. Like the things that you've mentioned that you've gone through are actually very logical once you understand. It's not that they're pleasant experiences, but if your lungs have been clogged up with chemicals and some kind of affluent stuff, you know, your body, when it's in a position to get rid of it, gee, it makes sense to get rid of it.
Yeah, well, the thing about it is, the stuff in my lungs, like, I could, my lung function was actually very good, you know, especially knowing that playing hockey, you know, like, you know, hockey is a very high demand sport, on your body, you know, your respiration, stuff like that. But I had no, you know, I would do a short shift, 45 seconds, and I'd be standing. Instead of sitting on the bench, I'd be standing, fighting to get air into my lungs, eh?
Uh-huh.
You know, and guys were starting to look at me like, what the hell, was I having a heart attack or something like that? I mean, I was just struggling to get air into my lungs, eh? But then that actually changed the level of hockey I played and all that sort of thing for, I would say, the best part of a year before I figured out what the MMS was and started taking it. That breathing issue, that's what actually caused me to do the other stuff, you know, the rose hips and the vitamins and all that other stuff, you know, that's what actually caused that, eh?
Uh-huh.
I was trying to clean whatever the hell was in my body out of it, and but nothing was that effective until I did the MMS, and then all of a sudden the shit came out of my lungs and I could breathe again. You know, and I'm still okay. I can still breathe just fine. I can take absolutely full breaths and hold my breath for a long time and stuff like that again. It's like a major change, eh?
Uh-huh.
But I still remember the day that I was exposed to the damn chlorine dioxide. I walked outside here, and it was just like a fog bank, you know, in the morning.
Yeah.
And the fog bank smelled like chlorine, and it was really strong, eh? And I'm looking up and down the damn street, and I walked back into the house, and I was just leaving in the morning. And I walked back into the house, and I thought, Jesus, what is this? Because if it came at night, I would have not heard the alarms, eh?
Uh-huh.
Because there's horns that used to blow at the pulp mill. Every time there was a release, these warning horns would blow, but now we have, our EPA is not recognized anymore here in Canada, and we have special citizens running these industries and stuff like that, so no alarms are ever set anymore. You know, see, if you have a discharge of chlorine dioxide or sulfur dioxide or whatever over here at this damn mess, this pulp mill here, you know, there's no warnings anymore. You never hear one of the horns going.
Wow, you just...
Yeah, you just take real big gulps and make sure that the sons of bitches running that mess over there get all the gambling money that they need for the weekend coming up. And that's exactly where we are today. And I don't care if it offends anyone. The truth is the truth. It's that simple. 46 stakeholders are making the money from that mess over there, and the rest of it are breathing it. And the Kamloops taxpayers are not part of the stakeholders.
Mm-hmm.
But why the hell would these sons of bitches want to tell us what they're doing over there? They don't have to, because there's no more EPA in Canada after mid-year 2002. And I am a direct product of that. The way that I think, the way that I act, the way that I research, the way that I've struggled to make my health return, and everything, I am definitely a product of that. So be it. I'll carry on.
Absolutely. Well, I'm happy for what you have learned and the fact that you share it, and hopefully others will learn and take that in, because, again, few people have had direct conscious experience with chlorine dioxide to be able to appreciate the difference with the chlorite matrix and how it's different.
Yeah, exactly. You'd have to actually recognize the problem, understand the problem, recognize the fact that there is a cure, then understand the cure. Mm-hmm. And that's just basically what I've done through research, is I've tried really hard to understand everything that is occurring and everything that I possibly can do, but then I want to follow it up and see exactly what happened and why it happened like it did. And that's where we are today. When I talk about the MMS and I refer to the papers, the documents, the statements, the abstracts, etc.
Right.
That explains exactly what we're doing here and why we do not want chlorine dioxide in our bodies.
Mm-hmm.
it's not gas. It's not the free radical.
That is one of the distinctions that none of the existing or predominant teachings about the MMS idea, no distinctions is made about that whatsoever.
Well, it's because of the origin of the horseshit on the CLO2 gas. See, no one even knew that it was CLO2 negative. No one knew that there were two species. You know, there are actually multiple species of chlorine dioxide.
Mm-hmm.
And no one knew that. No one knew the charge state was different. And no one has ever talked about the differences in the free radical itself. So when you look at all of the molecules of the free radical chlorine dioxide, and you look at how they are written differently, look at that someday. You're going to see some interesting things. Like the angle stays the same, but where's the charge? Is it the what is the charge? Where is the charge located? Things like that. There's other differences there. But anyway, back to the idea of the chlorite matrix. Well, we should be saying chlorite instead of CLO2 negative because it confuses the issue. The CLO2 is not there anymore as a gas, right? Just as a gas, it's not there anymore. But the molecule that created the gas is still there. All you've done is you've detoxified that molecule by getting rid of that gas. So if you say CLO2 that is detoxified,
mm-hmm.
So what are you talking about? If the chlorine dioxide is gone completely, why are we still saying CLO2? It's because that's what the molecule, the sodium chlorate, is actually called, eh?
Right, exactly.
The sodium chlorate can also be written as CLO2 negative because it does produce the O2, right?
Yes, it does.
Yeah, so anyway, but then it's gone right away, and what's left behind is the molecule. The molecule itself is in a small, incredibly small molecule that can be actually taken into the cell. And, it does good work. So if we look at it from that point of view, but, you know, as for inhaling chlorine dioxide gas, that'd be one of the dumbest goddamn things, pardon my expression here, but that'd be one of the dumbest things that a human being could ever do. And there is so much documentation on this, it's not even a guess.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the people that are actually stating that they are producing CLO2 as a gas, you know, from the combination of mild acid and sodium chloride, it's not CLO2. You're not producing it because it's gone, unless you're not adding enough acid. And there's no question that there is enough acid, so.
Okay, so.
What else are you producing, though? Let's say you think you're producing a gas. What else are we producing?
Well, part of the question along those lines has to do with whether there is sodium chlorate also in that mixture.
But in the case of Keevy's Corners, there's no sodium chlorate.
Yeah, we know.
It's that he's getting readings on test strips as high as 8,000. But the thing about it is the test strips aren't necessarily designed to read a dioxin. They are designed to read a molecule.
Mm-hmm.
If you're looking at a molecule that has already produced its gas, and the gas has already dissipated, the test strips are reading the molecule itself. So if you have 8,000 parts per million, I think he said in million, if I remember right,
mm-hmm.
Well, then the test strip is definitely not reading the gas. So let's say it this way. If you produced 8,000 parts per million of an actual gas, right, you should be able to weigh that material. You know, there's going to be a definite change in the weight of the water. You know, it shouldn't be that big of an issue. But the bottom line on it is, if you did the emission work on it, you know,
be clear.
Oh, you know, the mass spectrometry, the spectrometry. I can't even pronounce the damn word right.
Emission spectroscopy.
No.
Oh no. Yeah, gosh, I just messed that up. Spectrometry.
Yeah, see what I mean? It's a tongue, and there's four or five different words that actually say the same thing, different ways of, doing the experiments, eh? But anyway, the actual mass that's being checked, in other words, they're doing it through the emission of the waves that are coming off of it. In other words, let's say the emission of radio waves as an example, right?
Right.
When you're picking up a radio wave and defining what it is, let's say you're using an oscilloscope. Well, this is sort of along those ideas, but it's actually not. What you're doing is actually looking at the mist that the two impacted materials are producing, and you're just looking at the charge state, the fields, things like that. So once you have a baseline of data to work from, then you can say, well, yeah, this is chlorine dioxide, and this is not chlorine dioxide. But, and then you can look at the chlorine dioxide idea within the MMS or DCA, things like that. And then you're going to be looking for the potentials.
Yeah. Well, I do see also that a test strip is not going to be able to give you that kind of differentiation.
Well, it doesn't. It's based on different things.
Yeah.
You see, like, there are some things that test strips are based on that you know that if the test strip is reading one molecule present, you know that if that molecule is present, that there will be, as an example, chlorine dioxide gas produced, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if the molecule is present, and you use a test strip, and it says, well, yeah, ClO2 is present, well, then that thing doesn't check for the ClO2 after the acid is added. It's still going to be reading ClO2 because of the sodium chloride.
Yeah, because the molecule is the same. Charge is different.
Yeah, the molecule is the same, but the gas that it could produce is gone. So the molecule itself is secondary here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the sodium chloride is the beneficial part. The interaction of the sodium chlorate with the acid produces a very short-lived ClO2 negative in a gas state, and it dissipates, but it leaves the original molecule behind, but it can no longer produce a free radical. You know, in other words, that's expired, eh? It's completely used up. The potential of producing more free radicals is over. So then you get the beneficial molecule.
Yeah, I was mentioning that cascade of other things that occur afterwards, that those are the things that are beneficial.
Yeah, once the chlorine dioxide is gone, well, then the molecule itself is beneficial.
Mm-hmm.
So how is it beneficial? Well, it's small enough to get in through the sodium potassium pump. And is it in the right charge state? Yes, it is. It can get in, it can be attracted in, it can be useful. So how is it useful? So you look at the voltage-gated channels and why they stop working. What causes them to become dormant or damaged? You know, the dormancy is the insulation. You know, like if something is growing over or the amino acid required is gone. So then you look at the benefits of the actual chloride matrix and exactly what is that chloride matrix doing inside of the cell that causes the cell to return to normal function, as in the case of the trials in the WF10. Remember the production of ATP returns, T cells, hunter killer cells, all that kind of stuff, all the voltage-gated firings happen again?
They were normal again.
Yeah, you're back to normal again. So exactly what is this molecule doing? And that is what we're talking about. You know, forget about the damn chlorine dioxide as a gas, because it's gone. It's not part of the picture.
Mm-hmm. Got it. All right, that's how I see it.
Yep.
All right. This is a good clarification,
yeah.
And I know we may repeat these things from time to time, but we come from different angles, and it helps to paint and create a new picture of what's actually happening and why a lot of the criticism was unwarranted.
Well, you got to say it a little different,
yeah.
Believe it or not.
Yeah, I know. I'm thinking about that. I mean, it didn't even roll off mine. The point, basically, there was something else happening.
People behind the MMS idea, mm-hmm, that have actually looked at the documentation, you know, so if you start looking at the papers about what exactly is happening when sodium chloride is reacted with mild acid, and you look hard enough like I did, you know, then you start finding these documents that state that the chlorine dioxide as a gas, you know, as a free radical, as a gas, in other words, really bad stuff, that's gone. It's gone in a microsecond. So it's not even part of the equation. So therefore, you have no right to say that chlorine dioxide, because that's the death knell of this, eh?
Mm-hmm.
As soon as you say that chlorine dioxide is beneficial, that's the death knell right there. So the chlorine dioxide as a gas is not beneficial. It's a free radical that's really bad. But if you look at the molecule that produced it, and that molecule can no longer produce it, and that molecule is definitely in your body repairing your cells, now that's good. So if I would have been involved in this, let's say, way back in the day, I would have done all that research. I would have found in 71 work. I would have found that Cornford work right away because I knew of the background of the DCA.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be, well, you know, the journey. You know, if you start off on the wrong road, never going to get to the right place.
Well, or you're going to take a longer trip, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, now we're back to the right starting point. So the starting point being the fact that the chlorine dioxide is not present. So now we can rewrite this.
Yeah.
Look at exactly what is occurring and rewrite this whole idea following the science. You know, the stuff that the taxpayers paid for, that's being stolen now. You know, all these databases. Yeah, and I'm telling you, this is a real serious thing.
Yeah.
The theft of these databases, this is a bad thing. Bad.
I'm glad there was enough available so you could make the discoveries you did and that we could be having this conversation about it now, because I do see how this chloride matrix can be so helpful with this other stuff that we need to have people, or should say the powers that be, change and stop. But it means we're going to have to be the power ourselves.
Well, we are the power.
You know?
We are the servant. I had a conversation with a guy the other night about some of the first guys to declare themselves free citizens in Canada.
Uh-huh.
And there was a kind of an old hippie guy, you know, hippie type, that lived in a town called Delacoula. It's pretty much due west of Williams Lake.
Uh-huh.
And he was actually getting a lot of guys, you know, going on that track even 30 years ago, 35 years ago even.
Uh-huh.
You know, the Declaration of the Free Citizen and stuff like that. And apparently there was a textbook written about that a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm slowly tracking all of this stuff down so that we can put together some sort of a completely understandable method of doing this stuff, plus declaring yourself debt-free. And all that other stuff. Like that contract that I showed you that time, that is valid. That contract is one of the real things, you know, for the declaration of debt and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so there are certain forms and certain statements that have to be made properly and stuff like that to the right people. But yeah, you can become debt-free, and yes, you can declare yourself a free citizen, and if your financial state is at the right place, you will definitely get a check once you're a free citizen.
Well, first step is for people who are thinking that they're already free to realize that they're not. certainly they're not. They're not free in the eyes of the government, that's for sure.
Well, just get a hold of a broker, hand them your damn birth certificate, and get them to call it in and see what the value is.
Yeah.
You know, and then you know damn well you're nothing but a stock. You know, you're just a dead entity, a labor force. You're not even recognized as being alive.
Well, the stock would be of value, but things have been set up in such a way that a person, first of all, typically is not even made aware of it. And secondly, the government at all, they suck from it, take from whatever earnings one makes. But the person, the individual, is thought to be a non-entity in debt and simply a proxy, but never really gaining any value from it. So it's
the clawback idea, eh?
Yeah.
You know, so you take a look at the Institutes of Gaia, there are the wills sections and stuff like that, and then you see the fact that the clawback was actually designed into it to take your net worth away, at least a very large portion of it. You know, so basically, yeah, this is all the old Roman law. You know, the institutes, the canons, all of this kind of stuff. But I've said it many times, we that live under the Magna Carta in Canada, or you that live under the Maryland Constitution of 1776, we are not part of this picture at all. We are free citizens. We are the sovereign. The sovereign. The collective. The collective. The hive. We are the sovereign. And people have to know these things. These interpretations are very simple. We, the people, are the sovereign. Anyway, I got to get off the phone here, Adam. I've got stuff I have to do.
All right.
But the next time we talk, I would really like to talk about Fukushima.
All righty then.
Okay.
Okay then.
Yeah.
Thanks, Len. Bye.